Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Americans have been busy discussing President Obama's call to normalize relations with Cuba. Our next guest, a Lansing-based attorney, a longtime Michigan political insider, and a two-time visitor to Cuba, joins us next. Richard McClellan's two visits to the nation span more than 50 years. He visited as part of a group back in 2011. He also visited the country briefly in 1960 as a 17-year-old. And today, Richard McClellan also serves as chairman of the Michigan Law Revision Commission. Richard, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
First, tell us what you make of our country's move toward normalization with Cuba.
I think it was the right thing. I think it was a risk. It's not an unallayed good. It clearly, those who've been to Cuba and those who study it, it is a police state, and it has treated its people terribly. So there are some people who say we shouldn't recognize a police state. I'm of the different opinion that it's time after 50 years we try some other techniques to open it up. And having been there with a group, I think that it's the right decision. And as you might know, I don't normally agree with President Obama.
Did the president's move surprise you?
No. He had been saying that he would do it at some point. I think, obviously, it was a surprise in the sense that he immediately did it, but whether he was going to do it, I think he's going to use these last 2 years to do everything he can with his executive power. And a recognition of foreign states is a key power of the president.
Is it time to loosen up our trade embargo then? I mean, the bottom line to that question is, can economic change that may well ensue as a result of this move, can that economic change bring about political change?
I think it can, but I think we should loosen up some of the economics because they're good for us, particularly, say, agriculture. Michigan is a big agriculture state. We should be able to trade with Cuba. They have to import most of their food, so that's good for us. I think trade is good for America with everybody, even bad guys, because the people of Cuba are good. And if you're a believer that market forces can drive political change, I think, yes, it could help loosening up with technology, with communications, with just more American products. Right now, they love American products taken in by their family members that are Cuban Americans and fly in every week. So I think it's good. I think it'll help move the politics domestically in Cuba.
So talk to us about your more recent visit to Cuba. This goes back 3 years ago, 2011. How did that unfold?
Well, I've always wanted to go back after I was there in high school, and I finally learned that it was not that hard. I was able to get a license. Took about 15 people from town here and from Michigan. We actually flew in through Toronto because I was coming back from West Africa that day, and we could have flown from the U.S., so we flew in. We stayed in Old Havana. We went out meeting the people every night, meaning we went to bars and restaurants, and we had a wonderful day with a very devout communist official from the early Castro era. He had been the protocol director for Che Guevara and for Castro, spoke very good English, and we spent a whole day with him learning basically his view of communism and the revolution and the relations with the U.S., and we learned a lot in a short visit.
There have been indications that the Cuban government has no intention of letting go of socialism here, despite how much controversy the president's move has made. How did that former Che Guevara staffer talk about socialism in Cuba?
I think what he's told me was one of the more interesting things. He says, "Have you ever seen a revolution that lasts 50 years? The same people are in power after 50 years." He said, "Do you know why that happened? It's because of you, because we have created this fear of the people from the north, this massive country, and what they call the terrorists or the Cuban Americans." Now, the truth is they also have the Committee for Defense of the Revolution, which is the spies on every block. So he believes they are most interested in power in the same way the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Syrians. Power is important. Socialism, look, the United States can live with a socialist regime. What we'd like to see is a freer regime in terms of personal liberties and the ability to travel, the ability to speak and read and produce music and plays and that sort of thing. So to me, the linking between it's the Marxist ideology and the totalitarianism that's the problem. I don't really care that much about whether they try to continue to prop up socialism, meaning government control of everything. Even the Shoeshine boys, he admitted, this fellow we met with, when they first took over, they went too extreme. Even the Shoeshine boys had to work for the government. There was no private sector activity whatsoever. Mm-hmm. The only private sector activity, people would keep their cars. That's why they still have 50-year-old cars that run and 50-year-old houses that don't, because the government owns the houses and nobody wants to pay to keep up somebody else's property.
Of course, you know, in recent years, we've had a really dramatic example of a hardline communist nation, China, undergoing dramatic changes, changes that many people, millions of people, probably never would have foreseen back in the 1950s or 1960s. Does it cross your mind that Cuba might become a similar case, writ much smaller? Where over a period of decades, some number of freedoms and the democratic capitalism might actually start to take hold.
Yeah, I do. And I don't use China as an example. I use Bulgaria. I went to 1990 for President Bush, 41, to the election. And I went back 6 years later to the next election. It dramatically changed. Bulgaria was one of the most repressive Soviet satellite states in 1990. Mm-hmm. By 1996, they had, restaurants, you could buy American cigarettes, Pizza Huts and everything. Now they're a member of NATO. It's amazing in 20 years that it changes. So I think Cuba could be that type of country.
We're talking with Richard McClellan about Cuba, about his visits to Cuba and other matters here today on Current State. You first visited Cuba some years prior to that, 1960, I think, was the year after Fidel Castro took over. The country was drifting toward communism. Relations with the U.S. were worsening dramatically. Why did you go to Cuba as a 17-year-old? How did you get to Cuba as a 17-year-old?
Well, I lived in Papua as a town of 3,000, and I was sort of a policy junkie back then. I read Time magazine. I was interested in... We decided, well, we're 17, it's about time we went on spring break. Told our parents we were going to Fort Lauderdale. When I got in the car to leave, I told my mother I might be going to one of those islands down there. She said, oh, okay, be careful. Little did she know that for the last year I'd been writing to the government from my office in the school, because I was editor of the newspaper, school newspaper, so I could get mail in the school rather than come to my house. So we were guests of the government.
You were getting mail from Cuba to Paw Paw High School.
To Paw Paw High School, yes.
Okay.
Still have those letters. I have my student identity card. So we went down there, and we were met by them, and they took us all around for about a week.
But how did you get there?
Oh, you could fly. By that time, we didn't eliminate all travel until 61. This was 1960.
Okay.
So we still had American Airlines and Cubana Airlines. I tried to fly American Airlines. And they looked at it and said, no, we are not going to take you kids to Havana. So we went over to Cubana Airlines, and they said, oh, yeah, we'll take you. So we went there, and I remember they handed out banana daiquiris on the plane, and we decided that was the national drink of Cuba. So we would always order banana daiquiris, and bartenders would look at us strangely and, these kids want banana daiquiris. We'll make one.
How long were you there, and what did you do?
I'm not going to discuss everything we did, but we were there. But we that was a long time ago. But we traveled. The government took us around to farms and factories and propaganda stuff. That
so
they
you
did
just
for us.
Showed up. A group of you just showed up.
No, I wrote letters.
Oh, okay.
So they knew I was coming.
I
wrote letters, so they knew we were coming. And so, they were at the time trying to reach out to, what they assumed would be you know, left-wing students in America, which we were not. We just wanted to go someplace that nobody else went for a spring break.
Do you want to return to Cuba?
Yeah, I'd love to go back there. So, well, compared to last winter, yeah, I'd like to spend this winter there. They have beautiful resorts. They have lots of Canadians go down there, and they have these very nice resorts that I've told. We stayed in Old Havana in a very ornate old building, but it worked. It's not the Four Seasons, but it's a fun country to go to. The food is awful. All the restaurants are owned by the government, and they all do the same thing, unless you go to somebody's private home and have a meal.
We're talking with Richard McClellan here on WKAR in Current State about Cuba and other related matters. It is often described as a country frozen in time. Did it strike you that way in 2011?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, there's no question that it's just funny to see these 1950s American cars. 58, I think, is the last year they were really imported. So you'll get them from, you know, the 48 to 58 cars, all fixed up and fancied up, and they're the cabs, a lot of them. The buildings are crumbling. There's some nice areas. I mean, there's like any communist country. There's an elite, and some of them have good places. But, it's like any third world country that you might visit.
Your involvement was recently sought out by parties trying to bridge the gap in Michigan's Elliott Larson expansion effort to include the state's LGBT population. What happened?
Well, that's an interesting thing. The legislature is wrapping up, and one of the things they did not do was expand the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act to include people in the LGBT community. But what's interesting about it, in my view, is the legislature failed, even though both sides claimed they wanted it. The Republican speaker claimed he wanted to get this issue behind them, but it's about time. The ACLU and the LGBT community, I work particularly with the ACLU people, but they had different strategies. The question was whether transgendered persons need to be mentioned in the law. The speaker's office believed that the term transgender is included within the term sex because you say it's a gender expression. Very technical legal issue, but that's the way the federal government reports it. ACLU, on the other hand, and the LGBT community said, no, we want everybody mentioned. So you had this mixture of policy, legal issues, and sort of the LGBT community's sort of political stance, we all have to hang together. So we ended up not getting a bill that I think we should have gotten, and I was involved trying to bridge the gap between the two different groups because I just think it's time that we expand the civil rights protections to this group that is not covered.
You testified, and some others maintain, that transgender people in Michigan and the U.S. are already covered to some extent by important federal civil rights protections, Title VII protections. Is there disagreement over that?
Yes, there's disagreement in this way. It is, both sides agree it has not been tested in Michigan courts yet. But there are people within the LGBT community that agree with the interpretation that, yes, it should be included. So we might get that determined, but it's two different, there's no black and white groups on that. It's a complicated legal issue. Some people say we should follow the federal law, but we don't, and they mistrust the conservative judiciary in Michigan. Many people within the LGBT committee just don't think that the Michigan judiciary would enforce the civil rights law using the same interpretation as the federal law. Now, the fact is they've done it before, and they probably would. I am more of a supporter of our judiciary than most of the people in the ACLU are.
We've got just about a minute, Richard. What do you make of the road funding landscape here right now, politically and in any other way?
Well, that's another one that I know that the Quadrant has been leading, and I've been trying to help them think through how they can do it. One of the things that I think is wrong, this idea to take $1 billion from education and put it into the roads. The truth is the Constitution says the legislature shall impose taxes for the necessary expenses of government. Well, that includes roads. I think sometimes the Republicans forget there's a difference between infrastructure spending that lasts for 30 years and social welfare programs that maybe they don't agree to. So they don't want any taxes for anything. And I think they're wrong. I'm in favor of fixing the roads, and we have to pay for them. They're not free.
Richard McClellan is a Lansing-based attorney, a longtime Michigan political insider, two-time visitor to Cuba, and chairman of the Michigan Law Revision Commission. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.